Okay, so I'm going to present you some work. I'm going to present you some work that we have been recently doing in Rome on the growth of the first quasars, and especially how we can try to gain a better understanding of the early evolution of these distant objects by looking at the properties of the host galaxies, interpreting the observational properties of the host galaxies. And this project has been partly funded by the European Research Council through a starting grant, and it has received the input from many different collaborators, and especially from Rosa. She's here, so for all the dirty details of the models, you can directly talk to her or to me later on. And especially for the work that I will present you, we have been interacting a lot with people at other institutions that you, some of them you may know. So Chris Carilli has given a very nice talk a couple of weeks ago. Unfortunately, I was not here yet, and I look at the talk in streaming. But since I thought that maybe not all of you had done the same, I just start from a couple of plots that he has shown in his very nice review of the extraordinary observational work that they have been doing on these very distant host galaxies. And here you can see the far infrared luminosity as a function of the CO luminosity. And the high redshift quasars are shown here in stars. And again, this is a different plot. The black hole mass is a function of the velocity dispersion, and the dark and the empty squares are the observational data. Just to remind you what are the basic assumptions that need to be made to infer some of these observational properties from the data, I've sketched here a few equations. First of all, to estimate the far infrared luminosity, you need to assume that the dust is optically thin, that you need to assume dust temperature and an emissivity, and then you can infer the far infrared luminosity. And then these are the empty circles, the empty stars. And the filled stars are, after a correction, due to the AGN contamination. And they adopt, Wang et al. In their paper, they adopt this bolometric correction using the template of Elbis 1994. As for the this correlation here, black hole masses in this particular plot have been estimated from the bolometric luminosity. Although for some of these sources, of course, you have additional indications, and probably Marianne in her talk next week will give a better review of that. And the sigma is inferred from the CO line width, and of course you have the uncertainty related to the inclination angle. And in fact, this field and empty squares corresponds to different empirical calibrations of this relation, and also to different assumption on the inclination angle. And as you know, the fact that most of these points are populating this side of the plot have led to the interpretation that the black hole is growing faster than the stellar bulge for these high redshift objects. A few more words on these observable properties. Of course, by definition, you can infer the dust mass, which for most of these objects is in this relatively large mass range. I mean, it's 1 to 6, 10 to the 8 solar masses, so it's huge dust masses at redshift 6. And it is, as you will see, quite challenging to explain these huge dust masses in such a short time. Star formation rates are, once you have corrected for the AGN contamination derived by this relation, Kennicott relation, assuming a standard Salpeter initial mass function, and these are the order of magnitudes that you're talking about. H2 masses are derived by the CO luminosity, assuming standard conversion for starburst galaxies, and are the order of 10 to the 10 solar masses. And from this side, again, you can derive, infer from the CO line width the dynamical mass, again, you have to assume a scale length, and generally the average scale length that is assumed for these quasar host galaxies is 2.5 kiloparsec. The reason why is because for J1148, they could resolve the CO emission, and so they could derive this scale length. And again, you can derive the dynamical mass for an average inclination angle of 40. You have an estimate of the dynamical mass, estimate of the H2 mass, and subtracting the two, you can have an idea of what is the leftover, so the stellar mass in these objects. And as you can see, the stellar mass ranges between 10 to the 10 and a few times 10 to the 11 for these high redshift objects.
There's simply no dark matter.
I will come back to this point. Exactly. They're assuming very, very small contact. This is, of course, is an upper limit. And, okay, I'll get back to this. Remind me if I don't go there. So getting this upper limit on the stellar mass from subtracting these two quantities, here you see we have plotted the same, the black hole mass as a function of the stellar mass this time, and most of these objects again populate this part of the plot. So again, you have, of course, by definition, the same conclusion that the black hole grows faster than the stellar bulge. The stellar mass, I just explained that. No,
these are dynamical gas masses.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so the dynamical. It's not M star, but it is some kind of dynamical mass.
You know, you can usually this is what they do. I mean, it's just you don't have any other vein of estimate. Yeah. No, no, it's exactly the same. So we can discuss probably for hours if this this is true or not. And I think that there are persons in the audience which are have been actively working on that, trying to explain if there is some kind of selection effects or if this is actually a real offset. The approach that we have followed was to try to see if we could if we could have some additional clues on this possible offset by looking at the chemical properties of the host galaxies. So we know that for most of high redshift quasars in general, the hosts are very chemically mature systems. They show supersolar metallicities in both the broad and narrow line regions. And they have, as I said before, huge dust masses inferred from the rest frame for infrared emission. And so clearly, the question is whether you can have such a chemically mature system having an undermassive stellar bulge. And in fact, to produce heavy elements and dust, you need stars. This is trivial.
Sorry.
Yeah?
Undermassive stellar bulge.
Well, with respect to their black hole masses, I mean.
It's not undermassive in absolute terms.
Just one comment. In reality, we don't even know whether they have a bulge.
Yeah, well, okay. I would say, yeah, it is fair enough. But it's at least we can say that this is the stellar mass as inferred from the dynamical observation at 2.5 kiloparsec. Okay. So just a brief reminder, this is the normalized metal and dust yields for a burst of stars forming at the solar metallicity in the 0.100 solar mass range as a function of the stellar lifetimes. So this vertical line here is the Hubble time at 6.4, that's the redshift of 1148. And the different colors, also the lines here show the normalized dust yield, and these are the normalized metal yields. And the different colors correspond to different assumptions on the stellar initial mass function. So if you concentrate on the black solid, this is the ordinary saltpeter-like IMF. You see that massive stars are dominating the contribution of heavy elements, the enrichment in heavy elements. And as for the dust, you have a kick-on here, which is due to the additional contribution of massive AGB stars, which starts to be important at roughly 200 million years after the burst. So usually you see in all these papers interpreting the dust at high redshift written the following sentence: AGB dust is not able to contribute to the enrichment of these high redshifts. So it's wrong. It's wrong. AGB star can give an important contribution in relatively short time. And okay, so if you for instance concentrate on J1148, the upper limit on the stellar mass taken from the difference between the dynamical mass and the H2 mass is this one. And you know, you can do a back of the envelope calculation and you find that the mass in metals at redshift 6.4 is of this order of magnitude. And it gives you, if you divide by the inferred H2 mass, supersolar metallicity. But the mass of dust is about an order of magnitude smaller than what you need to explain the far infrared emission. So clearly, this seems to indicate that star dust, yes?
Is there a low redshift check of the prediction of the MZ by the M star?
MZ?
The M dust, right?
Yeah.
The dust, the depletion fraction.
Okay, so this is the subject of a different talk. But yes, we have used to model this curve, we have used dust yields for supernovae.
Theoretical
dust from supernovae that we have cross-checked with observations of newly formed dust in supernova and in supernova remnants, which is more important because part of the newly formed dust is destroyed by the reverse shock. So what is really able to be injected in the ISM is more representative of what is left in the supernova remnant. And for AGB stars, yes, there are calibration looking at observed mass loss in carbon stars in the local universe. So, yes, so this is clearly one order of magnitude lower than what you require to explain the far infrared emission. And so clearly you need some additional mechanisms. Some have been already proposed in the literature, like dust formation in quasar winds. This is an interesting proposal because it decouples the dust enrichment from the stellar population somehow, but you still need the heavy elements to form dust. And it is very, the efficiency of this mechanism is still very poorly understood because it depends on the many unknown properties of the winds. And so it is something which clearly deserves to be more investigated. But an additional possibility is to grow the mass of dust in dense molecular clouds. We know that this is actually dominating the dust budget in the Milky Way. And we know that in these distant systems, you have significant portion of the mass in these dense molecular clouds. So you can predict that this could be an effective way of growing the dust. And this idea was already also proposed by Michalowski and collaborators. So really, to address this issue, our approach was to try to use a semi-analytical model, GAMETE, that we have previously developed for different purposes. In this way, we could have possibility to study the problem in a statistical way, having the possibility to run different merger tree realization of a single halo at a high redshift. We focused on J1148 because this was one of the most extensively studied objects. And we could explore, tuning the parameters, different star formation histories. And then we have some, let's say, standard assumptions for the black hole seed mass, black hole growth, the gas accretion emergence, and feedback. And I don't have the time to go into the detail, but I want just to say that here we have all the dirty parameters that we were discussing last week. And of course, we use that because those were the ones that were calibrated with numerical simulation, so we blindly trust them. And then, of course, the fact that we have a semi-analytical model allows us to have a detailed description of the chemical enrichment in metals and dust on the stellar characteristic timescales, and we follow the cyclings in the ISM, so grain disruption by interstellar shocks and grain growth in molecular. So I jump immediately to the results. So the first scenarios that we investigated were that I'm showing you here were two extreme cases where the star formation rate was occurring in a very quiescent way on the dynamical time scale of each single progenitor of this huge halo at redshift 6.4, or was occurring with enhanced efficiency through merger-driven bursts. So you have some kind of two extremes here. And the star formation rate was tuned so as to reproduce the to be compatible with the upper limits of the dynamical mass. Okay. So now you can what you see here is the solid line is the average over 50 different possible merger tree realization of the J1148 host galaxy, and the shaded region that we can hardly see here is the one sigma deviation. And the path that is followed is the following for the two models. So at the beginning, you tend to follow the predicted coevolution between black hole and star. This is our local data, present day observations. And at a certain point, when the black hole grows up to a mass of 10 to the 8 solar masses, what happens is that black hole feedback starts to significantly affect the star formation rate. And then you have a steepening of this evolution, so black hole grows faster than the stellar mass. And in fact, you see this downturn in the star formation histories for the same reason. They peak at a redshift of around 8, and then they decline. And these are the predicted properties of the interstellar medium in these host galaxies, the gas mass, the stellar mass, the mass in metals, and dust. And as you can see, we are not able to reproduce the mass of dust, and we are not able to reproduce even the mass of metals. Metals are significantly depleted by these huge quasar-driven outflows, as well as the gas. So
explain to me. So here, feedback is affecting star formation and star quantity, but it's not affecting the
No, exactly. Okay, so this is clearly something which needs to be checked against numerical simulations. I have to say that this kind of steepening in the evolution is seen in some numerical simulations. However, in the semi-analytic, the reason for that is that essentially when we follow the accretion onto the black hole, we have the freedom to adjust the black hole accretion efficiency, the famous alpha parameter, which enters the Bondi accretion rate, and we tune this parameter so as to reproduce the black hole mass. So somehow we are saying that probably feedback. What we are saying is that feedback affects star formation before black hole itself.
Is about 100.
Is similar, not too different from what it is found in numerical simulation. Mm-hmm. So we were feeling that we were not doing anything worse than that, at least.
The way it affects the star formation, how do you do it?
I will show you in a minute. However, it's a simple energy-driven outflow.
It's an outflow,
yes. Okay, so the bottom line here was that the first models that we have investigated seem not to be able to reproduce the observed chemical properties, and the reason for that is that simply you need more stars. You need more stars to release heavy elements and actually fuel the grain growth. So. Next attempt was to increase the star formation efficiency. And in fact, here I show you again two different models, a quiescent model and a bursted model, which have an increased star formation efficiency. So now you can fit the observed chemical properties, but at the price of increasing the integrated stellar mass. And so essentially, again, you have this evolution where at the end, depending on the model, you can exceed the dynamical mass constraint by a factor 3 to 10. So another way to get around this was to change the IMF. So if you want to have, for the same stellar mass, an increased amount of metals, this is what you can do. And we have indeed tried this, and we show here, this is the prediction for, again, for a Poiseuian and bursted star formation rate. You can now fit the dynamical mass constraint, you can fit the chemical constraints, but you have to increase the characteristic stellar mass from 0.35 solar masses to 5. So it's a quite top-heavy IMF, and which may not be totally unreasonable in these very extreme environments for many different reasons, but still you have to tune this parameter in order.
May I ask another question?
Yeah.
This is exactly the opposite of what they're finding in all the nearby very old early types.
Yeah.
Modern heavy analysis. Now you sort of.
Yeah. But I have to say that the first in analytical models that were trying to explain the observations of sublimeter galaxy too have to resort to an increase in the stellar IMF. Actually, they were considering a flat IMF. They were not moving the peak of the IMF to higher values, but they were too they were having a very similar problem, a heavy element budget crisis.
Just to make a comment, the elliptical galaxies are exactly the same crisis. If you want a bottom-heavy IMF, they don't produce enough metals.
Exactly.
They produce the wrong metals.
True.
So the latest idea is the combination. But early on, you have top-heavy IMF, and then later on, you have bottom-heavy IMF, which is exactly your solution.
Yes, it can be, but I feel, well, although I work on this, I constructed my career on the possible evolution of the characteristic stellar mass as a function of the metallicity and dust-to-gas ratio, so I'm clearly open to that. I think that when you need to really resort to these kind of solutions, you may be missing some more thing, some fundamental process that you are not considering. I'm open.
Once you adjust the characteristic mass or the slope, you also change not only the acid abundance, the chemical ratios.
Yeah, we haven't seen that. This is interesting. It's an interesting possibility that we should investigate. Although I think that I haven't checked that. I did some work on that many years ago. I don't know if. Observational point of view, we have some more data to benchmark the models now, but I think that most of it was coming from relatively massive stars, the elements that you could measure. And so in this case, if you move the IMF to 5 solar masses, I don't think you may not have a significant effect on those kind of elemental ratios, but I'm not sure.
The early papers you referenced talk a lot about nitrogen abundance. No,
well, nitrogen is a nightmare for many different reasons. So
it's a secondary.
Yeah, exactly.
So that provides more information.
Anyway, I will show you that probably that's not the best solution, and that we should
but
revisit.
But it's Remco's point: is that the dynamics wants one thing, the chemical abundance is on another thing, which is a similar problem.
Yeah. Okay, so. So we have, again, at the end of this large parameter study, 4 possible scenarios which were able to account for the chemical properties. 2 of them were exceeding the dynamical mass constraints, and most importantly, they were predicting very different star formation histories and different star formation rates at the final redshift of the observations of 6.4. So we thought that.
Sorry, what is the arrow at 100? The red arrow on at 100 on the left.
Okay, this is because when you make this conversion from the far infrared luminosity, you need to assume an IMF. So this is an IMF dependence of the conversion. So all the star formation rates, this to get to Lucio's point, so all the star formation rates were showing this downturn in the at redshift below 8, and that was due to the effect of black hole feedback. That was modeled in a very simple way, as you can see here, this is the predicted outflow rate. However, without, I swear, changing any parameter, we realized that it was predicting approximately the right outflow rate as compared to the observed one for J1148. So these are the observations that also Chris was showing in his talk by Roberto Maiolino and collaborators, where they were seeing, they have seen these relatively large wings of the C plus in J1148 at a scale of about 8 kiloparsec. And so they could infer a lower limit on the outflow rate of about 3,000 kilometers per second. And that's our prediction for the four models. They show similar predictions because at the end, the black hole masses are similar. They are accreting more or less at the same rate. So clearly the predicted outflow rate is comparable in the four models. And it is dominated by the AGN. These blue lines shows you the contribution of the supernovae. And of course, since the star formation rate is downturning already, supernova. Mm. So some features of these four scenarios are very similar, such as this downturn, but the final value of the star formation rate is very different, and this depends really on the adopted star formation efficiency. So the possibility to try to further discriminate among these four scenarios was to look at the predicted SED, and we were motivated to do that by a recent release of Herschel data. Now, at least for most of these Redshift 6 quasar, but especially for J1148, we have a really good coverage of the far-infrared spectral energy distribution that can be compared with observation with theoretical models. To do that, of course, although we have used an adaptive Monte Carlo radiative transfer code developed by Simone Bianchi, of course, we could not model the whole transfer from the accretion radius up to the scale of the host galaxy. This is too computationally challenging. So we had to resort to some sort of intrinsic AGN plus dusty torus emission. That's our intrinsic input radiation source at the center. And then, of course, we could predict the spectral energy distribution of the stellar components using the output of the same analytics coupled with spectral synthesis models. And then we could mimic the dust in the host galaxy using, again, the output of the semi-analytics, so the dust-to-gas ratios and the dust distribution. And dust distribution, I mean, what is the fraction of dust in cold clumps and what is in the diffuse medium and so on and so forth. So a few details on that. As for the input spectrum for the accretion disk and dusty torus, we were guided by recent work of Staleski and collaborators that were instead doing the radiative transfer in the clumpy dusty torus around the black holes. And they have released many different models changing the clumpiness of the disk, the optical depth. And so we found what was the best model that could account for the observational properties of J1148. So this is the blue line that you see here. The data points, of course, are the observational data. And this is the predicted phase-on view and edge-on view of the quasar in the model. And what you can see is also a red line here. This is the Richards et al. Template for type 1 quasars. And as you can see, if you normalize it to the UV, this is under-predicting the near-infrared emission. This is a well-known problem for these high-redshift quasars, which have Herschel detections. We can comment on that later, but clearly it requires some additional contribution. So what we did was to try to reproduce this Staleski model in different components. We have the first power law slope, which we take from the Marconi et al. Spectrum for the accretion disk emission. And then we have this in black, this mid-infrared emission, which is essentially due to a fraction, which is approximately 23% of this bolometric luminosity is emitted in the face-on direction, so it is unabsorbed. The rest is emitted in the other direction, which are passing through the dusty torus. And as a consequence, there is a strong near-infrared component, which you see here in black, which is almost isotropic. And this is due to the fact that the dusty disk has a moderate optical depth, 0.1 at 10 microns. And so it is emitted isotropically. And then in addition to that, this near-infrared component is about 40% of the bolometric luminosity. There is a fraction of the optical luminosity that can escape even in the edge on direction, which is this flat component. And in decomposing this intrinsic spectrum, we were really guided by these full radiative transfer models of Stalesky et al.
Excuse me, the Marconi, the component from Marconi, where this is from observations or from?
Yes, it was an empirical interpretation of the observation.
So they found that it's isotropic, they
were sure? They were assuming it to be isotropic. They were assuming to be.
This, it's probably not isotropic.
I agree with you. I agree. I totally agree with you. But I mean, this is it can explain at least the power law. It is meant especially to explain the power law that you observe here. And this is clearly an indication that the fact that you observe this power law, that the quasar is in phase on at least day 1148. Okay. So this is for the intrinsic SED. Then, of course, you put this intrinsic SED at 300, within 350 parsecs, which is the scale that we are not resolving with the radiative transfer. We zoom out and we want to explore the effects of the dust in the host galaxy. The dust has these kind of properties, so we put the most of the dust in. We explore two different cases where we have 50% of the dust in the dense molecular cloud and 50% in the diffuse gas, and then 100% in dense molecular clouds. And we have this kind of surface density for the clouds, which is taken to be the same as the H2 surface density derived from the observations. And we assume also two different dust emissivity, typical SMC dust emissivity and small Magellanic cloud emissivity and a supernova dust emissivity curve. And then we run the radiative transfer.
The clouds very large, two times more than 27 solar masses per cloud.
Yeah.
Much larger than the GFC.
Right. This is consistent with what they find from the CO observations. Yes, we were quite surprised as well. And we talked to Dominic Rikers, and he was confirming that this is what it comes out of their modeling, more or less. Yes. Of course, we have we couldn't afford to go, but that would. Increase the critics, the mass of dust to lower values of cloud radius because of resolution problem, but this would even increase the mass of dust. So this is the kind of the grid that is used to explore the radiative transfer. It's adapted, so we could zoom in the most advanced regions. And this is the an image of at 40 microns of two different cases. One is where the central source, the only source of radiation is the AGN at the center. And so you can see that, so we have artificially switched off the stars here, and you see that the clouds are illuminated only from the center. And since these clouds are very optically thick, only the surface of the clouds is illuminated, really. But when you have the stars in the clouds, of course, all the clouds are illuminated up to much larger distance from the center. And then here are the results for, I show you the results here for only two models. The B3 model that was the one which was predicting the largest stellar mass at the end, and one of the two other models, B1 with a top-heavy IMF. So the first striking thing is the contribution of the intrinsic stellar spectrum, which is, of course, much larger in this case, because in this case, as I was showing you before, the star formation rates at redshift 6.4 are much lower. And then, of course, you have the optical and near-infrared component, which we just described before, and you have the thermal emission that is coming from dust in the host galaxy heated by the stars and by the AGN. And as you can see, the model which predicts a lower stellar contribution cannot make it. So it cannot really reproduce the peak of the emission. And you need to have sufficient star formation ongoing in order to heat up the dust here to the observed value. However, we were quite surprised to find that the AGN itself can contribute to dust heating by a large fraction. I mean, 60% of the observed far infrared luminosity at wavelengths larger than 20 microns can be accounted for by AGN heating. So you need the stars, but these are not necessarily the dominant contribution. Okay? Then, of course, we have different lines here. The red lines correspond to the supernova dust emissivity curve, the blue lines to the SMC. You see that you probably need some mixed properties because you need the SMC to predict this feature at 10 microns. This is a silicate feature. But you need to have probably a different emissivity curve at long wavelengths to account for this long wavelength data. And you have dotted and solid lines, which corresponds to 50% of the dust in molecular clouds or to 100% of the dust in molecular clouds. And of course, the observation seems to indicate that probably most of the dust, the majority of the dust mass, has to be in these dense molecular clouds. And this is consistent with our need, because, of course, we need to have the dust in molecular clouds to grow it efficiently and to reproduce the dust mass. So the results of this comparison between the models and the observed SED seem to require that you need to have a star formation rate of at least 900 solar masses per year, as predicted by this model B3. You need to have dust mostly distributed in clumps with mixed emissivity properties. And the fact that the emissivity properties have to be somehow a mixture between the SMC and the supernova-like dust resonates with additional observational evidence for this distant quasar done in observational studies done in extinction by Simona Gallerani and others.
How are we to understand this result that AGN dominate? Is it because stars are embedded in optically thick clouds and basically don't see them?
Because, okay, of course, the stellar contribution is like an upper limit because you have put all the stars inside these dense clumps, okay? So you might further decrease the stellar contribution if you somehow randomly distribute the stars around the molecular clouds instead of putting them at the very center, okay? And the AGN contribution, what is mostly contributing to this far infrared emission is, I would say, half and half. The far infrared part of the emission, so this, the near infrared part of the emission, the one that is responsible for this part here of the SED, and the fraction of optical radiation that is escaping the dusty torus. So this is somehow suggesting that the dusty torus around at least this object is not really optically thick. Okay? So it's about the optical depth is 0.1 at 10 microns. And another reason to think that is that you see this silicate feature in emission. If you look at this
cloud, you assume its total mass and its size.
The clouds, you've been the clouds in
all
the.
Of them are the
no, in the host galaxy, you mean? These are in the host galaxies, so they are.
Are they all the same?
Yes, they are all the same, and they are concentrated in these 2.5 kiloparsec. They are meant somehow to reproduce what is inferred from the CO luminosity. Okay. Sorry.
Are those clouds around?
Yeah, I mean we are assuming that we don't we are not modeling the dynamics of these clouds, but are simply taking for granted what they what comes out of the observations.
Yeah, it's outside. It may be outside their own tidal radius.
Outside?
Their own tidal radius. It's just the numbers sound big to me. The clouds sound big. Are the results sensitive to the parameters you can use for it?
We have explored different possibilities for that. However, I would say that when you look at these papers on the that interpret the CO luminosities and the spectral energy distribution of the line intensities of the CO, Chris Carilli was showing the plot in his talk. Actually, what seems to be required is that this is a giant molecular cloud. This region that they observe is a giant, like a giant molecular cloud by itself. Okay, so it's they require densities which corresponds to the very central density in the Milky Way giant molecular clouds. So I don't know if there is a bias in the observations, but of course if you try to interpret these observations and use these indications to model the clouds, this is roughly what comes
what is the
number.
Factor?
The covering factor is I don't remember the number. I should tell you later. But it is we have explored that. And for instance, since our average density in the clouds is somehow on the lower limit of what is required to interpret the line intensities of the CO, we have done some numerical experiments increasing this density. Of course, you increase the mass of the clouds and you decrease the number of the clouds. So
for this particular
yes, and you decrease the number of the clouds, so you increase the filling factor. You decrease the filling factor, and you cannot reproduce the observed for infrared emission longer because essentially you tend to distribute the clouds too far from or at least to intercept the clouds too sparsely to reproduce the far infrared emission. So this kind of study has somehow suggested that you need to keep on forming stars at a sufficiently high rate down to the observational redshift, the 6.4, despite the effect of the quasar feedback that we have seen. It is more or less consistent with the observations. However, if you want to form stars at a high rate for, you know, to meet the chemical constraints and the SED constraints, then the integrated stellar mass is going to be larger, and it's going to be a factor of 10 larger than what can be inferred from these dynamical mass constraints. So the next question that I leave you is to try to understand where are these missing stars, and if you make a simple model where you distribute the star according to a singular isothermal sphere density profile, and you can distribute the star, you need it to distribute the star to a radius of about 20 kiloparsec. Okay, what you are observing from the CO is 2.5 kiloparsecs. And if you look at the simulations, for instance, this is a very nice paper that came out on the interpreting the observational properties of the host galaxies in the massive black simulation, massive black hole. And you can see, for instance, it's very hard to make a one-to-one comparison because they don't have an extreme object such as J1148. But if you look at this is the virial radius, So this is the virial radius of the halo. This is the final snapshot at redshift 5 in this case. And this is the stellar mass surface density. And you see that the stars, the active star-forming region is at the very center, true. And this is what we also need. We need to distribute this 10 to the 3 solar mass per year star formation rate in the 2.5 kiloparsec that they are observing to reproduce the observation, the observed emission. But the stars that you have formed, those that you have formed in the progenitor, they are distributed on a larger region here. So it might be that these stars are actually outside the radius that is proved by the dynamical mass observations. And then to go back to your question before on the
it's a standard baryonic fraction.
Okay, in general, in all these observations, they assume that the dark matter is not contributing. Okay? So I did this very simple exercise when I was preparing this talk, and I took a Navarro-Franklin-White profile. I assume that for the observed number density of this quasar, the halo mass is predicted to be between 10 to the 12 and 10 to the 13 solar masses. And there is a problem that the density profile depends, of course, on the cosmology, but especially on this concentration parameter. The concentration parameter is not very well constrained for these massive high redshift objects. Here you see two different results that I could find in the literature. One by Munoz, Quartas et al., where you have the concentration parameter as a function of redshift, and you should concentrate on these two lower curves. This corresponds to halos, which have roughly the same masses as here. You see that as you go to larger redshift, the concentration parameter decreases from something which is between 8 and 10 to something which is approximately 4. But the largest redshift is 2, so you need to extrapolate this up to redshift 6. Seems to be fairly flat, but you don't know. Instead, in this other study, you should concentrate on this magenta line here. The magenta line is for redshift 6, and it is seen here as a function of the mass. Unfortunately, they get only to 10 to the 12 solar masses, but it seems that if you extrapolate these to larger masses, you get back to relatively large values, and this is the redshift zero case. So it's very contradicting. According to Andrea Machò, this result is, they don't trust this result, and he suggested me to consider this redshift 2 value as a good indicator, but of course it's challenging because you need to have sufficiently good resolution at high redshift with these huge halos. But it's something which I would really like to see better constrained. And if you take these two extreme possibilities for the concentration parameter, this is the profile, and this is the mass enclosed in a given radius. 2.5 kiloparsec, this is the upper limit on the dynamical mass. For 3 out of the 4 cases, the dark matter is more than 90%.
Exacerbates the
problem, and which may suggest that actually these are not virialized systems. You cannot really use this dynamical mass as a proxy for the stellar mass.
Something you had, and I didn't quite understand, at the beginning, you said they estimate the stellar mass by assigning a certain fraction of the far IR to AGN and another fraction to stars.
No, that's the star formation rate.
Star formation rate, but then you came up with a rather different fraction.
Yes.
Of AGN, so that again changes.
No, but I was not using their constraint on the star formation rate. In fact, we allowed ourselves to vary the star formation efficiency because we thought that it was not obvious that the stars were making all the observed far infrared luminosity.
Not critiquing what you said, but in general, all the Herschel papers have assigned a very large fraction, in fact, usually 100% of far infrared star formation.
I know, but actually, in this last paper by Lipsky et al. It's very interesting, and for, I don't think I have the plot here, but what they are comparing an average far infrared SED for Herschel detected quasars, objects, and for Herschel non-detected quasar at redshift 6. And what they see is that the Richards et al. Template is able to fit the Herschel non-detected objects, but is not able to fit the Herschel detected objects. And so there is a very final sentence in their paper in which they say that this is, might suggest a correlation between the near-infrared emission and the far-infrared emission due to an increasing contribution of the AGN to dust heating. Generally, I have to say that all the papers where they make this correction, they simply consider the far infrared contamination from the intrinsic light coming from the AGN. They are not considering the possibility that the AGN itself can contribute to dust heating in the host galaxy. It's a very different topic. It's a very different problem.
Comment on that. Don't there two papers that have compared the CO luminosity with the far infrared both for AGN and non-AGNs that showed that they have a similar distribution?
Yes, there is. It was the very first plot that I showed, and just to emphasize that even if you decrease, this is a log-log plot, right? So if you decrease these points by a factor of 2, making this correction for the AGN contribution, you would bring them even closer to the locally observed correlation. Okay? So your point was that having a big AGN...
No, yeah, I wasn't thinking that one there, but they looked at more AGNs, not that just this one, I think it was
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where they find consistency in general. So I don't know about these.
Well, you can see here, I heard Chris in his talk saying that this seems to suggest that indeed most of the far infrared luminosity is coming from the stars.
Yeah.
However, if you correct for the large fraction that we have found, this would bring these points even closer.
Okay.
So there is space for contribution from the AGN from the observational point of view.
Just a comment. There's one thing that might help you on the issue of the monomical versus the
lens. Yes.
I'm pretty sure the planetar, I don't know about the other one, I'm pretty sure that the planetar and most of the papers who estimate the concentration, they use just dark matter only simulations. When you have the baryons, it's well known that in the merger you get a lot of contraction, adiabatic contraction just because of the inflow of gas.
Sure.
And so effectively, I think it's more reasonable to assume that all the mass is the all the dynamical mass is there, stars and gas.
Yeah,
within a few kiloparsecs. Yeah.
Surprising.
Right?
No, sure, but what happens to the dark matter? It is the concentration is
decreasing
because of the baryons.
Well, you have essentially you have a much. I mean, most of the baryons are say within a few kiloparsecs, and the dark matter is. Outside.
No, but what I'm comparing is exactly.
Suppose that you don't have any baryon.
Yeah.
The dark matter profile itself, the Navarro-Franklin-White profile, the mass enclosed within 2.5 kiloparsec is already almost exceeding the dynamical mass constraint. So unless
you find a way with the baryons,
maybe through less, like is it
done for local force to somehow
distribute the dark matter to flatten
the dark matter concentration at lower scales, small scales. If you add the baryons on top of that, you will eventually make
the problem
more creepy.
But of course, I mean,
no,
if you're interested in doing
simulations of that, I'd be happy.
You know because of this effect, you could keep it in a lower mass halo because you get the baryons boosting.
But the halo mass constraint comes from other.
Yeah, but I mean
indications like the number density.
So even if you take the lower limit for the mass.
Yes.
Okay,
you have to take the lower limit and the lowest concentration parameter, and in that case, the dark matter contributes to 40%. Okay? So it will be compatible with the dynamical mass constraint, but it will make even more critical the smaller the space to fit the stars in.
Okay.
You see?
Well,
What duty cycle does the normal density constraint assume?
I don't remember, but it's quite.
Okay. Yeah. So you could get around by lower.
Yeah, but the mass function is very steep, right? The halo mass function is very steep,
if
so you
if
at this.
For this quasar, if you compare the mass growth time to the universe, then it allows you to duty cycle
yeah.
much less than 0.1.
Yeah.
I think 0.5. So,
plus the
specific object is, unless you see some exotic characteristics, it's a safer bet than for most other
objects.
So, meaning the lifetime you're assuming is something like.
The lifetime cannot be longer than.
Yeah.
Sure.
If there is something certain, this is.
If you objects where you can see.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Today you cannot, but then you could.
Yes.